Blog Talk Radio.
Live to see it, friends. You're listening to Fast Forward Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. Fast Forward Radio is an audio production of The Speculist. You'll find us online at speculist.com. That's speculist.com. Or go straight to the blog at blog.speculist.com. At The Speculist and on Fast Forward Radio, we explore a convergence of emerging technologies and emerging possibilities which lie at the heart of this, the greatest period of transformation in human history. Our world is changing in ways that are difficult to predict, sometimes even difficult to imagine. And Fast Forward Radio is your guide to an astounding future that lies ahead and that will be here sooner than you think. My name is Phil Bauermaster, and with me in the virtual studio is my co-blogger, co-futurist, and co-host, Stephen Gordon. Hello, Stephen.
Hey, Phil. How are you?
Well, I am super fantastic. How are you, my friend?
Oh, man, I'm doing great. I'm excited about the show tonight. We've got a good one lined up. Hey, have you seen, I guess, surely you've seen Avengers by now, right?
I managed to see that over the summer when it was actually just out for a couple of weeks. I made a point of going to see that.
Okay, all right. Well, it's now out on DVD and
DVD, yeah,
you know, iTunes and any other way you want to get it. And the kids and I watched it right before showtime, and we had a great time with it.
How fun. Have you seen it before?
Oh, yeah, yeah. When you've got kids the age of my kids, you cannot avoid seeing a movie like Avengers. And we just had a good time watching it again. I think that's like the third or fourth time for them. I think I saw it once in the theater. No, maybe twice. Yeah, I think it was twice in the theater, and tonight it might have been the third time. So I had a great time with it. Maybe you won't.
So,
Shmarma,
Go ahead.
I was kind of hungry for shmarma or whatever it was they were eating at the end.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. Go ahead and grab some of that.
Yeah.
Well, it's a really fun movie. Enjoyed it quite a bit. Makes me wish that DC would get their act together and Warner Brothers would get their act together and make a good Justice League movie, seeing the Avengers so well done. But they took their time and they worked their way up to that. You know, they established all these characters and they established the relationships and the storylines. And there was this question: if they brought it all together, would it work? Would it not work? And it worked tremendously well. It's a really fun movie. My favorite part has got to be the fight between the Hulk and Loki. That's
I don't know that you call that a fight.
Well, I'm not sure the fight is actually the right word, but the conflict, the clash, the I won't give it away to anyone who hasn't seen it, but let's just say that one of those two clearly dominates the other in no uncertain terms. It's a great humorous effect. It's probably pretty easy to guess who's who in that context.
I doubt you're getting away.
Yeah, it's a fun movie.
Yeah, we had a great time watching it again. But at any rate, I guess that's pretty much, that was today. So anyway,
there you go. All right. It's all a good movie, and now you're doing your weekly
shows.
Venture into the future here. So let's jump into it because, you know, we got a lot of material to cover tonight. Let's face it.
Absolutely.
We've taken on a fairly sizable challenge. We're actually doing our favorite kind of show tonight, which is a show where we don't know everything that the other guy is going to say before he says it. I've assigned us a topic. I said, hey, let's come up with some reasons why we should be optimistic, and then each of us have come up with a few. Now, how we came to do that is I was completely inspired by an article I read over on the Time Magazine site earlier this week, actually just a couple of days ago. And, you know, Stephen, we've been talking about the fact that it's an election year, and we'd really like to hear more from the candidates along the lines of the kinds of things we talk about on this show. So how encouraging was it, you know, in this election year to finally have somebody step up and make the case for optimism? And not only somebody step up and make the case for optimism, but someone who has, at least in the past, 16 years ago, most recently, been a presidential candidate.
Well, That's right. That's right. It was Bill Clinton. And Phil, did I send you the link or did you send me? I think we might have, like, you know, simultaneously pinged each other when we saw this article by Bill Clinton in Time Magazine. You know, I mean, it's to me the remarkable thing about it, unlike the speech that he gave most recently at the DNC, there was not much in the way of, you know, politics or pushing, you know, a particular view of on the right or the left. This was just, okay, here's some things that we can all be excited about, regardless of political persuasion.
In fact, on Facebook, I made a point of saying, why don't we hear this from people who are running for president? But you just answered that question. Because once you get onto the subject of why we should be optimistic, the things that we should be hopeful about, the reasons we should actually be maybe less fearful about the future, more excited about the future, it's very hard to push an agenda. It's hard to get people scared, and it's hard to beat up the other guy with that message. And it seems that our... for good or for ill, and I'm going to say for ill, our presidential campaigns have come down to pretty much those things, right? Get people as scared as you can about the other side and put the other side in as bad a light as possible. And everybody plays the game because everybody else is playing the game, so I'm not pointing fingers at one side or the other, just saying that I'd really like to see somebody try this, you know? I'd really like to see somebody come out and give this message and say, this is happening, and rather than fighting it or ignoring it, we need to get behind it. And if we get behind it, we're going to bring about all the kinds of changes that you know, the president is always theoretically offering us, or you know, keep all the promises that they would like to make, and then some. Right? Because I mean, this is your ultimate campaign platform. The world is getting, they even used in Time Magazine, even used the phrase better all the time.
Well, you know, to me, I you know, the sunnier candidate often prevails. You know, I mean, that's you need to. I would say a winning strategy is not just fear of the other guy, and you know, a lot of times these guys that are running, you know, they could use surrogates for that, and then you know, you be the sunny guy. You know, you have surrogates,
well,
you know, beating up the other
Obama
side.
I mean, that's what Obama did in 2008, right? I mean, that's how he did.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah, you know, you never deign to criticize the other side. You're too big for that, and you paint the sunny vision of the future. And often, you know, candidates have done that, and often they prevail when they do. And so, yeah, it just seems like there's not a lot of that this time around.
A lot of fear.
It's kind of a joyless. I've heard it described as a joyless campaign on both sides. I don't argue with that. I really don't.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
This was a good article. This, you know, this what Bill Clinton wrote, you know, is so much to be optimistic about. And so I guess we can kind of begin by mentioning a couple of those things.
Yeah. Well, let's start with that and just say that if President Obama and Governor Romney don't have it in them to give this message. Thank you, President Clinton, for giving that message. If we knew how to, we'd send you a coveted Fast Forward Radio coffee mug, and we're gonna join him in getting that message out. So if you can't get it from presidential candidates, you can always count on your friends Phil and Stephen to give you this message. So always come here for this message. But Clinton, he lines out a good case for optimism. He talks about a lot of the kinds of issues that we see in books like The Radical Optimist or In Abundance. He talks about the technology that is truly changing the world, and as he says, freeing the world, and that is the smartphone. And, you know, we've talked about that, I don't know, dozens of times on this program, just how radical a piece of technology the smartphone really is and the kinds of opportunities that it's opening up all over the world. And you can't help but be aware of how it's doing it in the developing world, and just how fundamentally it's changing. I mean, you know, we go on and on about how smartphones have changed our lives, right? And
right.
We're living at the peak of the developed world. For folks living in rural Africa, as we always like to point out, or a lot of, you know, rural India, a lot of parts of the world where a good deal of the 20th century hadn't even made it, they're suddenly deeply embedded in the 21st century, and able to leapfrog able to move ahead in ways that wouldn't have even seemed possible a decade or two ago. It's astounding the change that those phones are bringing about, and it's not just a technological change. It's very much economic. It's very much social. Very much political kinds of change that are being empowered there, and really, really exciting stuff. He also talks about improvements in health infrastructure. He talks about the coming of green energy. Now, this is one area where there's always huge bits of, there's enormous political debate. And, I think what it always comes down to is green energy gets debated just because it's so often subsidized. But I don't think that there's any argument that the technology is at some stage of development and is developing rapidly and will be a lot farther along fairly soon. Is that the – did I actually say anything there
I'll tell you if you ever are not saying something. No, you're just –
okay.
You got words coming out, but there's no meaning there. I get it.
What I'm trying to say is that sometimes it gets overhyped, right?
It's hard to overhype something that is this revolutionary. Put it this way, I'm not even sure we should still call these things phones. They're not, when I was growing up, that beige thing on grandma's, little thing in the hall, that was a phone.
Right.
I don't know what this is. This is something completely revolutionary that we carry in our pockets everywhere.
This is a portable computer, now portable assistant. I mean, with Siri, it's a person in your life in addition to being kind of a command center network. But actually, I was off the smartphones. I was talking about green energy. So that one does maybe get overhyped. You might agree. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Well, yeah. I think often what happens is it's obvious that this is where we're going, okay?
Yes.
But if you push the wrong parties, if you bet on the wrong horse and throw a bunch of money into the wrong group, it just doesn't work out. I think probably a better plan is just to let it happen. Don't be throwing billions into various experiments like Solyndra and others. Just it's coming, and let it compete on a basis with other forms of power.
Yeah, I think as the technology develops, it becomes inevitable. That's what I think.
Right.
That's what I think
right.
happens. And the problem is our desire for it gets ahead of our ability to implement it and give results, but the desire for it and the lower level of technology that's available gets the government subsidy, and then it becomes this self-replicating thing, and then people say, oh, see, these sources of energy aren't real, they're never going to be real, and it creates this needless.
That's the thing. Yeah.
It
tends to be people on the right that are going, oh my gosh, this is just such a crock, it'll never happen. And then
right.
you got people on the left that are cheerleading when we're not quite there with either battery technology or grid parity, and so you err on both sides.
Right.
It will happen, and it's going to amaze the people on the right. When all of a sudden it'll be like the cell phone. At one point, 10-12 years ago, people had car phones. That's what we called them.
Yep.
It was a cell phone in our cars. It was wired in. And then all of a sudden, a few people started getting cell phones in their pockets, but they were pretty big and things like that. And all of a sudden, it just happened. And it happened as the price kept just plummeting to the point that there was no point in not having one. And so that's I think that's pretty much the way it'll happen with solar.
That's what will happen with I think solar energy and a lot of these different green energy initiatives. Although I would dispute one point. I think people on either side will stubbornly refuse to be amazed and they'll act like they expected it all along. That's
all
that's,
along.
That's,
all
yeah,
along.
Yeah. That is what will happen there.
I imagine when it shows up, the folks on the ride will say, "You see, we just had to wait."
Yeah, there. I told you we'd have solar power. Yeah. The other two that President Clinton mentioned in his piece were equality of women. We've talked about that quite a bit, the changing roles for women, greater opportunities for women, that in particular, technology is opening up around the world, really reshaping how the world works. And I would refer everyone to that YouTube video, the TED Talk I posted a while back about how revolutionary and radical a piece of technology the washing machine is. How that can, you know, we talk about smartphones and they're huge. Also, washing machines are also also really huge because it suddenly frees up all this time traditionally for women during the day, and suddenly they're able to work outside the home, or they're able to do other things that they weren't able to do before. So you see this, and that being just one example of how technology is enabling a completely different approach to life from what we've known before. And Clinton adds all this up and talks about how the world is enjoying not only greater freedom, but greater justice as a result of all this. And we're going to touch on that one a little bit later with one of the items that I had on my list. But anyway, we spent too much time on President Clinton's five, because we've got 10 of our own that we'll need to dip through here, Stephen. So I'm going to let you go first. Give us President Clinton gave five reasons to be excited about the future. We're going to give 10 more. Let's begin.
Okay. All right, I'm going to just throw out this as kind of a broad category and then give some examples. Energy revolution. Now, I know we talked just briefly about green energy, and that is going to be huge. That's going. We'll see solar reaching grid parity in different places at different times based on how much sun you have and how expensive the electricity is in the area you're in. For example, I would say that Hawaii is already there because their electricity is almost entirely diesel generator produced, except for the solar,
right.
And that's actually cheaper than the diesel power. So we've reached it there. There'll be other places like California that will reach it very soon. Actually, where I'm living, Louisiana, will be one of the third or fourth tier places to cross grid parity in probably in about 10 years. So that's huge. But that's that's just part of it. I fully expect that nuclear will be a big part of our clean energy future. Was interested in reading something over at Future Aware. It's actually a Twitter handle, I believe, of Brian Wong at Next Big Future. And he's talking about success for uranium from phosphate plant. In other words, they're taking phosphate and producing uranium from it. And, of course, that's just traditional nuclear fuel there. Of course, there's more advances all the time in the area of fusion. I believe that we will get there. I don't think it's going to remain, forever 20 years in the future. I think it'll be something we'll get to eventually. And, lots of helium-3 on the moon. I think that we will use that for our fusion at some point. And so we have here in Louisiana a pilot plant in Alexandria, Louisiana, that's very interesting, I think. It's gasoline from natural gas, wood pulp, and solar power. They have a process using wood pulp, which is very abundant in this area, natural gas, which is huge in this area. We have lots of that. And we have lots of solar power in Louisiana. So it's kind of we have it all that's needed for this particular process, and they're producing gasoline from it. And
we've heard a lot about cellulosic ethanol. Now we're talking cellulosic gasoline here.
Exactly. And they're producing it for about $1.50 a gallon. And so they're making a lot of profit at this price point that we're at right now. And unfortunately, high gasoline price, but fortunately, it creates opportunities for people that are trying new things. And so I just say we have lots of potential in energy, and I have not even come close to listing all the ways that all the things we should be looking forward to there. But we have a abundant energy future ahead of us.
I couldn't agree more. I think that there are more options for how we might get energy than there have ever been before. I think that's one of the things that people don't consider when they talk about, for example, peak oil, which even the concept of peak oil is heavily under scrutiny right now because it seems like people keep finding more and more oil all over the world. But even assuming the claims of peak oil to be true, you know, if we'd hit peak oil in, say, 1965, that would have really...
It would have been a problem.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
If we had run out of
that
oil then, that would have really been a problem. Because what
yeah.
else was there? Well, we had Three Mile Island-style nuclear plants, right? And we know what happens with those sometimes. And I don't know what else, you know, coal, right? We might have started making gasoline out of coal. I mean, even then, there were options. There were things to do. But today, when you think about just the myriad of different ideas that are being tried and that seem to be working to one extent or another, you know, to at least some extent, it should be encouraging to anyone to look at our energy future and say, you know, I think we're going to make it. I think we're going to be okay.
Yeah.
If algae doesn't work out and cellulosic ethanol doesn't work out, maybe cellulosic gasoline will. If the old model of nuclear fission doesn't work out, well, maybe the new model will. And, in fact, I think that we'll probably experience just a few of those. Probably just a few of those things will settle to the top, and it's entirely possible that before we even get to helium-3 on the moon and fusion, that we'll be so good with solar because of nanotechnology that will just become the go-to energy source, and we'll use that for everything. One possible.
I agree. We it's, you know, there's just so many different possibilities. So yeah, absolutely.
An abundance of possibilities. And speaking of abundance, my first item is on the radicalness of 3D printing. This is a piece by Valkyrie Ice over on Accelerator, and I'll go ahead and I'll put the link here into the chat room. And I'm embarrassed that I don't know whether Valkyrie Ice, I see this individual all over Facebook and all over the blogosphere. I don't know whether Valkyrie is a male or a female, so I don't know what pronoun to use here when talking about Valkyrie. But this piece is awesome. Talking about the major progress that's being made in 3D printing and where it's taking us. Let me just give you a quote here. Look at this from the manufacturer's side. The only cost they have incurred is the R&D cost of designing an item and the cost of running a website. They don't even have to concern themselves with obtaining the raw materials to make an item from, nor do they have to pay a staff to run the printers, pay the electric bills to run the printers, rent a building house to house the printers, pay a transporter to haul the products to market, have a warehouse to store extra products. In fact, they will put all of those issues off on the customer. All that they will have to be concerned about is designing a product, testing a few dozen prototypes to fix the rough edges, and voila, a market-ready product at minimal cost that need only sell a few thousand copies to pay off design fees, at which point everything else will be pure profit. This is as radical a transformation of how the economy works and is going to work as you can imagine, as big a change probably as occurred with industrialization to begin with. And Valkyrie, I think, very convincingly makes the point that this moves us in away from an economy based on scarcity, smack in the direction of an economy of abundance, that a world in which we're printing our own stuff, where we're making our own stuff, is going to be a world where people are much more self-reliant and where the, you know, we were talking about just now about how many more options are available to us in the realm of energy. Now imagine so many more options available to us in the realm of just about everything, right? Because once you're able to produce your own manufactured goods, everything becomes customized, everything becomes exactly what you want it to be. And the price point for consumer goods is going to experience the same kind of decline that we've seen in the price point for, say, purchasing music or for buying movies or something like that, where you're no longer actually buying an artifact. Time was you would buy a record or a cassette tape you'd buy a VHS tape to watch a movie or even a DVD. Even that much of a physical artifact seems to be sliding away. As those information, primarily information-based products, became purely information, the cost to produce and distribute them dramatically fell, and the cost of accessing them dramatically fell. And that's why we have this incredible abundance available to us of entertainment these days. And it's why we'll have very soon an incredible abundance of material goods available. Valkyrie goes on and talks about how 3D printers are also being used to print stem cells, which is going to have radical implications for our health and for our longevity, and also will probably be the driving technology behind, what's the right term for this, ethical meat, for meat that can be produced by anyone who's got a printer that can print out stem cells. We called it vet meat in the past, although that wouldn't exactly be the case here, because you'd be, you know, just print out a steak for dinner, basically is the idea. So we're getting closer and closer to this, and it's noted that the Motley Fool is now recommending people invest heavily in 3D printing because it is very much seen as the wave of the future, and it's something that's coming very soon.
Absolutely. Speaking of the Batmate, there's a company that is being backed. Is it Peter Diamantis that's behind it? He's put a lot of
weight. It seems like he's behind a lot of things.
Yeah, he's in so many. That guy's in so many interesting things, and I think it is him. He's behind one of these companies that's working on the problem of ethical meat, and it's interesting. Their first product to market, they expect it to hit the market sometime next year. It's not going to be a food item because that's just hard to not make it gross right now. They're still working on making it palatable business. I remember a few years back there was some of the first efforts kind of came out looking like tumors. We don't want to eat that. We want the steak to look and feel like it's a steak in our mouth, taste like a steak, and all that. So they're still working on the issue. Their first product is going to be leather. They are printing leather, and they say they're very happy with the progress they've made and feel that they will have the ability to produce convincing leather without any animal having to die. So I think that's pretty cool, and that's step one towards what their ultimate goal is food. So
ethical leather is a great start. Looking forward to that ethical porterhouse, you know, with the T-bone right in there and medium rare, and that's very exciting stuff. Well, I note that interesting discussion going on in the chat room. KGH says that powerful interests will find 3D printing dangerous and will prevent it, except for the very wealthy and well connected. Now.
I've heard that theory before, KGH, and a lot of very smart people, subscribe to that. I disagree. I think it's going to be one of these things that's just not possible to control. It'll be ubiquitous. Everyone, you know, it's like. Trying to control, it'd be like someone that's a vested interest in a printing press saying, I like the fact that everybody has printers attached to their computer. We're going to shut that down.
I think the corollary would have been, did anyone really make a serious attempt to prevent laser printing from occurring? Not really, right? I mean, you know, certainly there were people with vested interests who didn't like the advent of that. And there have been big-time efforts by the music industry to keep some of the technology that we enjoy on our desktops from coming into play. But, you know, what always seemed to happen is a bootleg movement eventually became legitimate. And I would imagine that that's the worst-case scenario for 3D printing. Even if all kinds of controls are put in place, the cat's out of the bag. People have 3D printers in their homes now, and they're building new and better ones. And it started as hobbyists. The same way personal computers did. So I have a feeling that that it would have to take a pretty intense crackdown to keep that from happening at this point. Okay, we're about halfway through the show, Stephen. We got eight more items to go. So let's keep moving. What do you got?
Okay. Let's see here. My apologies. How about driverless cars? Now, this is something it seems like we talk about quite a bit on the show. I hope we're not beating this dead horseless carriage. Anyway, it's one of these things that it just sounds like it's going to be just kind of a convenience. But it turns out the more that you look at it, the more it's, you know, the more it is. There's just the matter of the number of accidents that we have in this country. I was reading in the Wall Street Journal this week, the cost of automotive deaths to our society every year represents 2.6% of our GDP.
No kidding.
That's what we lose every year in the costs of taking care of maimed bodies, dead people that, you know, I mean, you know, the productivity we lose and people that die and those who are disabled and we have to, you know, that go on disability because of an accident, things like that. That's what we're talking about. This can be improved upon. We're talking about machines that never blink, never get sleepy, don't get angry, don't get distracted. They're all, you know, they can look in more than one direction at a time. They don't have blind spots. And they don't get lost. They know, you know, every road is you know, they know it well in advance. They're experts in every road that they're programmed to drive on. So we're talking about a system that once it's commercialized, I think, put it this way, I don't think it'll be on the road until it's a better driver than we are. And it's likely to put me out of business, to be quite honest. The majority of what I do, I'm a personal injury attorney. Couldn't be happier with this. I will find something else to do happily when this happens. And I think it's coming very quickly. We're going to see this roll out in the next 5 to 10 years. We already see some things like active cruise control and other things that, you know, parallel parking, automated parallel parking, things like that, and some of the luxury cars. It won't be long. It'll be here, and it'll make us safer. It'll free up road congestion, you know, by allowing cars to drive closer to each other than we could do on our own. Things like that. It's just going to be great.
It's a win-win all the way around. Well, I mean, the first time you send your car out for gas and you don't have to go, right? I think people will be sold on it. I'm going to go to bed. You go get gas and then come back, put yourself in the garage, and we'll see you in the morning, right? I mean.
Well, think about it this way, Phil. If one of the reasons that, you know, people tend to have a lead foot and, you know, burn more gasoline than they need to on their daily commute is because they're anxious to get there because the drive, they're not being productive, they don't feel, during the drive, right?
Right. That's right.
Well, you know, if I've got a completely automated car and I can sit there and do work on the way to work or do other things, maybe something I'm enjoying, listen to music, kick back, whatever, play a video game, whatever I want to do. I don't feel like I have to speed, right? I'm having fun where I'm at, so I can tell the car maximum economic ride today. You know, just get me there and never let the never let the revolutions per minute get above a certain level. We're just gonna ease down the highway today because I'm in no particular hurry. I think you'll see a lot of that.
I think so too. And you know, it's not just the need to speed. The frustration people feel in traffic it will be greatly offset by the fact that they are able to distract themselves doing other things. You can be on your cell phone and not worry that you're being distracted from driving, or you can work on your computer, or you can do anything you want. Plus, traffic jams won't be as bad because the whole thing will be optimized. And unfortunately, human behavior is such that we create horrible traffic jams. Driverless car behavior is going to be cooperative in a way that humans can't be, because it's almost like they're going to be telepathic, sort of reading each other's minds and anticipating each other. And the traffic jams, though there will be slowdowns, will not exist the way they do today. Traffic, among other things, is going to get a lot better. It's a tremendous move forward in so many different ways. And I don't know if you mentioned or if I sent you, there was a story in the Register, a UK paper, about quoting Sergey Brin saying, "Yeah, we are. Anybody who wants one can have one in 5 years." Now, whether the infrastructure is actually going to keep up, and by infrastructure I mean legal infrastructure, is actually going to be there. A prediction that anyone who wants a driverless car in 5 years can have one. that's a pretty sweeping statement. And I don't know that I want to get in an argument with Sergey Brin about what's going to happen in 5 years around technology that he's been working on for well over 5 years. So we'll see what happens. But I'm looking forward to getting my first driverless car. I can tell you that much.
It's going to be huge, and it's going to happen fast. People are going to be shocked. It'll be adopted as fast as the smartphone.
I think so. Okay. Well, listen, I've got a solution for your job loss based on the driverless car.
Okay.
This is a piece in H Plus magazine, and it's by Peter Rothman. It's called "The Future of Work: Everyone is a Performance Artist." What do you think of that idea?
I was just going to add that, that could perhaps one of the things that you could do if you're a performance artist is design things for 3D printers.
There you go. Exactly right. I think that's probably another job that stays around for a while anyway. Machines are going to get better and better at designing things. I've talked a lot on both this show and over on the Transparency Revolution about, what does happen to work in a world where more and more things get automated, more and more of our jobs are being automated. And it's a really interesting example that you just gave, Stephen, because it's not that the job of personal injury lawyer gets automated. It's just that automation so improves the automobile traffic situation that you're not needed anymore. It's like one of those unforeseen consequences, although it's foreseen in this instance because we're talking about it. But there are going to be a lot of those kinds of things where employment that used to exist just won't need to exist anymore because of automation. So what are we all going to do with our time? I mean, we've talked about this extensively and how the economy will work and all those kinds of things. But this is a somewhat whimsical answer, but I really like it. Because as we approach the singularity, more and more of our mundane tasks will be offloaded to robots, AIs, and various types of hybrid man-machine crowdsourcing systems. Or so some of us hope. But if it happens, what will be left for humans to do? We'll spend more of our work time studying, inventing, and creating. So there you go. There's your designer job. We'll also be collaborating and communicating, as well as organizing and running projects together. And that means making presentations. Managers already spend a good deal of their time crafting things like PowerPoint presentations. And I can attest to that from my own personal experience, that I've probably spent 40% of the last few years of my professional life, no kidding, 40% dealing with PowerPoint one way or another. between PowerPoint and Excel, put it that way. Business presentations generally fall into two categories: informational presentations, goal of the presentation is to transmit relevant information to the audience and have them understand and retain it, and persuasive presentations, the goal of the presentation is to persuade the audience members or members of the audience about a specific decision or course of action. And of course, many presentations combine both elements. It goes on to say that it might not be PowerPoint, and we might not think of ourselves as performance artists, but increasingly, that's what many of us are going to be doing. We're going to be sharing information with each other. We're going to be either informing each other, providing good information to each other about specialized topics that we've educated ourselves about, that we've gained information about, or trying to bring each other into a better understanding and, basically change each other's minds about how we should be approaching certain things. So ultimately, we all become, I think performance artists is a much, much nicer take on it than, what he might have said, which is middle managers, right? we're all going to be flogging around with our projector and our PowerPoint, trying to persuade everybody else that we've got the answer. No, we're going to be performance artists. We're going to be people who have something interesting to say, who are passionate about something, and who are sharing that perspective with each other. How you build an economy around that, I don't know. But it sounds like good work if you can get it. And I think, Stephen, you'd make a great performance artist. I look forward to seeing the kind of work you're going to be doing.
Well, I'm kind of practicing that both here and writing at the Speculus. So that's sort of me being plugged in for the future right there.
Hey, I guess we do have a bit of a head start, don't we?
Yeah. Well, I was thinking, about the performance artist who is creating designs for the 3D printers. Maybe kind of a model in that, in what a lot of these garage bands are doing. They're, you know, a lot of them are producing just very high quality music. And every week, I play at the end of the show a song that's completely free to me. You know, they encourage people who are doing podcasts, hey, take our music and play it. We want it to be heard. And I think there's going to be a lot of that. There's going to be a lot of giving away of product by these people. Now, how do you make a living doing that? Well, it's a high volume business, but when you are paid, you're paid in other ways, and you get small payments that just come in when you can, I guess. And of course, when everything that you want to buy is cheap anyway. And abundant, maybe you don't need to earn all that much money to be living quite nicely.
Exactly. We've talked about the future of the economy, and we can't get into it tonight. But there are a lot of different models for how the economy can resolve itself. There's a question in the chat room about what about massive unemployment. Well, you know, we've done hours and hours of shows about that, and it remains a potentially sticky problem. Although there are possible solutions, there are possible roads between here and there where things look pretty good, and I think we've got to play it smart and take one of those paths. But let's move on. What's our next reason for optimism?
Okay, medical advances. Medicine is just another information technology, Phil. It's like, you know, and information technology. Maybe it wasn't always that way. To me, it takes smart people who know things and always has to be a good doctor. I mean, even, you know, Civil War doctor, you know, you had to have a reasonably smart person who understood medicine to the best that was understood in that day and age to do that. Well, what's needed more and more, we're going to be needing things like Watson, who's going to med school and learning to diagnose better than any human can various forms of cancer. There's this news at NPR in the last couple of days about how scientists have parsed the genes of breast cancer and found that there are four major types of breast cancer. And that might mean that in the future, it's not going to be, oh, you have breast cancer, well, we need to do this and this and this. It's going to be, oh, you have breast cancer, what type? Okay, you got that kind of breast cancer. What stage are you in? And then we're going to deal with it that way. And the way that you deal with one type of breast cancer over another is going to be quite a bit different. So I would say, just like any other information technology, it's subject to exponential development. Where we're going to be in 10 years is going to make today's medicine seem primitive. We'll be having our own version of medical tricorders. That's already in the works. And our smartphones that we really shouldn't call phones anymore are going to be tricorders as well. And eventually we'll have onboard doctors, but that's maybe a few more years down the road. But that's reason, you know. It's reason to be excited. I mean, it's we have a medical crisis right now because we're at sort of the awkward teenage point in our development. We're no longer complete primitives, but we've not reached the point where we've got personal health care. And when I say health care, I mean actual care to stay healthy rather than sick care, which is what we really have. And it's a huge drag on our economy what we've got right now, but we're going to get past that. It's going to happen quickly, and it's reason to be optimistic.
There are so many things you can say about healthcare, which is one of the reasons I kind of glossed over that when talking about President Clinton's list, because I knew that was one item on the list that we're going to hit here tonight. Justice is another one. I'm going to come to that in just a minute. But in fact, I also had healthcare on my list, and specifically cancer. Let me put this in the chat room. Great piece over at the BBC. All these British sites I'm citing tonight for some reason. I don't know why. Cancer death rate set for a dramatic fall. Really, really interesting research here. Death rates from cancer are set to fall dramatically by 2030, according to Cancer Research UK. It says fewer people smoking, as well as improvements in diagnosis and treatment, will lead to a 17% drop in death rate. And, you know, this is UK-specific, but extrapolate to elsewhere in the world, right? About 170 UK deaths per 100,000 population were from cancer in 2010, and this figure is predicted to fall to 142 out of every 100,000 people. Some of the biggest killers, lung, breast, bowel, and prostate cancer, are part of the trend. The biggest fall is projected to be in ovarian cancer, the death rates dropping by 43%. Now, why is this happening? Why do we see this happening? Well, we've got much better detection, better lifestyle, better prevention than we've ever had in the past. Obviously, treatment is getting better. It's still not exactly what we want for cancer, but it's clearly getting better. Different kinds of cancer are becoming more survivable. But what's, I think, so encouraging about this article, Stephen, is it takes none of what you just said into consideration.
Yeah.
I think
they're going to be shocked when they get they're going to see what they the sort of improvement that they're talking about by 2030. They're going to see it by 2020 or before. It's
right.
I think it's going to shock everybody how quickly we move in the field of cancer specifically.
Well, this is one of those areas we do have a few topics we come back to: smartphones, driverless cars, and tremendous progress with cancer, just because it's a thing that bears mentioning once in a while, which is how fast and how broadly progress has been made on this front over the last few years. And I've said this before. Decades ago, when I was a kid, even when I was a young adult, you know, there was no big breakthroughs in cancer research. You didn't hear that, hey, suddenly we've got, you know, a much better way of treating cancer. Yes, they were coming up with radiation that was better than the radiation they were using before, and yes, they were coming up with chemo that was somewhat better than the chemo they were using before, but nothing like the kinds of breakthroughs that we've seen with nanotechnology, with gene therapy. And as you mentioned, we're just in the very early stages. I put a piece up on Better All the Time just last week about a treatment for leukemia, particular strains of leukemia. It looks to be extremely effective using dandelions. Okay, they're taking dandelions, making tea out of it, and curing leukemia. How does this happen? Well, it's just that, you know, you put enough researchers working on something for a long enough time, and you try enough different things, and suddenly you find things that were right in front of us all the time. So it's this convergence of improved treatment, radical new treatments, better detection, a more information-digitized approach to the problem. All of these things come together, and suddenly cancer becomes what we've been saying for some time that it's going to become, something that people live with. The way they currently live with something like diabetes. Cancer becomes less and less the death sentence that it used to be, and more something that that, you know, people find they have to find a way to live.
Right. And, you know, it's something that they periodically have to beat into remission. And go see their doctor. Once they get into remission, just go see your doctor every 6 months.
And the key will be catching it early, not because you're going to die, but just because that way you don't have to go through so much treatment, right?
Right.
You won't feel as bad. That will be the big deal about cancer. Okay, what's next?
Okay, getting off this planet. This is something that put it this way: we just shouldn't have all of our eggs in one basket, Phil. I mean, there's just with technology increasing the way it is, there's also the exponential fall of the IQ necessary for to be the guy that ends the world, right? What did he call that?
Oh, the
Moore's
the,
law for mad
Moore's
scientists.
Law for mad scientists.
Exactly, Moore's laws for mad scientists. So we probably should be a little bit concerned about that. So what do we do? Well, we need to have thriving outposts, throughout this solar system at least, and wouldn't be a bad idea if we were to go elsewhere too. And we talked a little bit about one possibility last week. There's NASA has some guys locked away in a closet somewhere working on the issue of warp drive, right? Probably a little less, of a dark project is. The something that's being worked on, the Lagrange Point Project, They're considering an outpost on the far side of the moon. And I saw an article, Fox News, on that, and I'll put the link in the chat room here in just a second. But I think what we really need, Phil, we're beginning to have the capability of doing this, is have an off-world DNA library of the entire ecosphere.
Yes.
Everything. You have everything logged. Every creature, every plant, every animal, and have it off-world. And, the capability is beginning to be there. You've got guys like Craig Venter that are already doing their very best to begin building that library. And I think that we need a concerted effort to do that and then have it located in various places. We already have a seed bank. It's just for seeds up in the Arctic. Maybe we could have a DNA bank, perhaps in the Antarctic someplace.
On the moon,
perhaps.
On the moon. If we felt like we needed to go as far as the Lagrange point or perhaps Mars, just have the entire library of everything there. And so I think that's a fine idea, and we're beginning to get that capability. I think that we're going to gain the capability in the next 30 to 50 years, and I think we have a good shot of surviving until then. So that's a reason to be optimistic.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. You get your backup of the biosphere up there, and if worse comes to worse, we've got the pieces to start it all over again. If it should ever come to that, speaking of space, I almost added this one, but I couldn't quite make it part of the case for optimism. But since you've introduced space, I can kind of squeeze it in. Have you seen that guy? And I don't have the link here with me because I looked at it and didn't copy it. I should have. The guy who did a skydive from 72,000 feet is getting ready to do one from 120,000 feet. He's getting ready to break the sound barrier on his way down skydiving. And, at 120,000 feet, you are essentially out into space at that point. You're on the edge of space anyway. And I looked at the platform that he did his dive from last time and the outfit that he's wearing. And this is essentially a space capsule, and he's wearing a spacesuit. Granted, he's not in orbit. He's not going 17,000 miles per hour. There was no rocket involved. But we've talked about how balloons and lighter than aircraft provide this alternative means of getting into space. And we're seeing more instances of this where not only is there a whole new space tourism industry coming online, a whole new actual space industry coming online, but a whole new interest in accessing the upper atmosphere and I think ultimately space. But just by getting up there, right? Just by taking a lighter than aircraft and getting yourself as far up as you can possibly go. That's aeronautics and not astronautics. But it's a big move in that direction. I think it'd be really interesting to see what happens as people continue to move themselves further and further into space.
That's right.
Okay. We're moving quickly. Okay. I'm sorry. Did you have something else on space?
I was just going to say, with lighter than aircraft, one of the things that have been kind of a limiting factor is how balloons tend to explode when they get up near space. What keeps a balloon from exploding here where we are at ground level, of course, is the pressure that's being pushed against the balloon from the outside. And you don't have that as you're moving into space, but there are some pretty exotic materials that are being tested, and I think the day when we get into orbit using lighter than aircraft, it's approaching.
Hey, we're getting closer, that's for sure.
Yep.
Okay. Next up, I've got a piece called this gets to the peace and justice portion of what President Clinton wrote. A great piece over on Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies by our friend Aisha Khanna, who was on the program a while back talking about her book, Hybrid Technology. Her article is called How Technology Promotes World Peace. And I'm just going to read a little section of this. She says, it's a little surprise that some observers see historical patterns of competition playing out in China's rise today. The Asian power is behaving in some ways like a classic mercantilist empire, locking up natural resources across continents, while flooding global markets with its cheaper goods. Some of its current account surpluses have been plowed into military investments such as Blue Water Navy, space-based weapons, and cybersecurity. Since the rise of the Song Dynasty in China a millennium ago, you might say there's been a hegemonic power transmission somewhere in the world about once every century. That's not a scientific formula, but it certainly informs speculation that China might someday surpass the U.S. on the global hierarchy. But as the world potentially faces yet another round of national competition, there's one factor that is leading the powers, great and non-great alike, to be more cooperative and less competitive: technology. As states become more populous, urban, and interconnected, they're more reliant on technology, medicine, agriculture, communication, and so on. Technology requires long supply chains to build and cross-border cooperation to develop with, both of which are easier if states cooperate rather than compete. Even as technology evolves to suit military objectives and is often guided by the military, we might be about to enter a sort of pact technologica of global stability through, in part, technology. Great, wonderful image of where things might be heading. And China is such a wonderful example of that, because when you think, 20 years or even 15 years ago, it seemed like we were gearing up for this big showdown with China. And boy, it sure doesn't feel that way today, does it?
Yeah. And I'll leave you the story of what you posted on Facebook, Phil. I think it's illustrative of what you're talking about. You posted this awesome picture taken by the Hubble Space Telescope of all these galaxies. And you, Phil, you spent a good deal of time in Russia. You've made some Russian friends, and I guess those are people that are following you on Facebook, is that correct?
No,
not
just a Facebook friend I've made since then, not someone I met while in Russia. But either way.
Okay, all right. Anyway, this Facebook friend of yours, Phil, made a comment in Russian. And the comment that he made was concerning the stars. Yes, some new stars are being born all the time.
Right.
You were stating how can you count all these stars? And the answer, of course, is no. And these were not just stars; these were galaxies. And his comment was, "And new stars are being born all the time." And I clicked like on the comment, and you asked me, Phil, in Russian, you asked me if I understand Russian, and I responded in Russian, yes, but only because Google is part of my brain.
Right.
And, that was a kind of a funny exchange that you and I had, but completely impossible a few years ago.
Absolutely.
And that's the sort of thing that, the very fact that the language barriers can come down even just a little bit. It was, it's sort of awkward to have to go back and forth to Google to translate, and to just to have a conversation like that. But it's, it's getting less awkward all the time, and it's something that's going to be virtually seamless in a few years, and that allows lots of cooperation with China or Russia or any place.
Absolutely, couldn't agree more. Okay, yep. You got 30 seconds for your next one. Go.
Okay. All right. Well, I was just going to say that Clinton was correct about the smartphone, but it's not always going to be phone-shaped. We're not always going to refer to it as a phone. Eventually, it'll be the eyeglasses, instead of the iOS. It'll still be the iOS in it, but it'll be in our eyeglasses, and that's a coming thing. We're going to see that within the next 5 to 10 years. This is our technology becoming more and more intimate with and tied to us, so that it's whispering in our ears the Russian that we need to say when we're talking to people or typing on the internet or whatever. That's
right. Make that exchange we had earlier today real time, right? Where,
exactly.
You can just have your own conversation with somebody. It's like it doesn't matter if they speak another language. So what? Let's talk. Okay.
Exactly.
My final one is just in case you're worried about dying, since we've solved all your other problems here this evening. A great piece by John Smart. I just linked it. This was also over at IEET. Brain preservation to live forever. We can call this one immortality 0.09, okay? So we're not really to immortality 1.0. But John is head of an organization that is pursuing development of technology around preserving brains through plastination. And he gives good reasons why this is a superior way to go over cryonics in terms of the expense involved. It's much cheaper, and in terms of how soon we'll be able to deploy it, he says we'll be able to deploy it much faster. Now, I'm going to call this immortality 0.09 because, Stephen, as you know, you and I have this discussion frequently. I feel that if my brain gets plastinated and I get rebooted there, that maybe I don't make the trip, right? I don't come along for the ride. But it is a great way to back up and make recoverable all the information housed in all the brains that that people have. And it's a coming technology. We'll be here much sooner than you think. Stephen, what's our music?
Our music is Just Like You by Brian Sharp. Had a great time tonight, Bill.
Brian Sharp sings Just Like You. 2 weeks from tonight, we've got our big fifth anniversary. Don't miss it. Thanks for being with us. Until next time, live to see it.
Too long to figure out, but I guess there's something I could say. If I had done things different, would you still feel the same? And if I had made a choice, would this mess be swept away? Must we wait till we can breathe again? Until our eyes can open up and they can see again. Yeah, we move through this world so blindly. We take our blinders from the past. We never take things lightly, though. We only take things way too fast. Just like you.